Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A very good evening and a very, very warm welcome to Dick Lovett. As I'm sure you will all agree, this is a truly incredible showroom. I think if men did go to spas, they'd probably look a bit like this. It is truly amazing. By the time Dick Lovett started in 1959, a certain Italian manufacturer had won four Formula One Drivers' World Championships, they'd won five World Sports Car Championships, and they'd launched the beautiful 250 GT road car. There's no way we're going to cover all of Ferrari's history tonight, but hopefully we'll give you a real insight into some of the sports car racing from the 1960s. So please, can you put your hands together and welcome David Piper and Richard Atwood. Richard, I'll start with you. You've won so many races in your time, you've raced sports cars all over the world, but it all really started because your father was a car dealer.
Well, yes, he was my my sponsor, effectively, because we had garages, and when I started, we just took the first two cars out of the showroom, basically. One was a little standard 10, and then I did a full year with in 1960 with a TR3A, and it was a totally unmodified car, and in scratch races I was averaged about fourth place. I couldn't win races because it wasn't fast enough, and the other cars have got fiberglass panels and Weber carburetors and all this sort of thing. So the end of that year I wanted to modify the car to beat everybody who had been beating me that in 1960, and my father said to me, he said, well, you don't want to bother with that, he said, we'll get one of these Formula Juniors. Well, I didn't even know what he was talking about. So he was very much, you know, the push behind me, and as he'd raced in Brooklands in the 30s, he had to make a business for himself, so he didn't actually race very long. And I think he continued that through my racing, you know, 30 years later.
David, you spent many, many years before you got into Ferraris racing other cars, but am I right in thinking that your sort of first time you sort of fell in love with Ferrari was when you saw a fellow British driver whizzing past you in the Targa Florio?
Yes, I was working on a farm. I was a tractor driver, and I used to be very interested in motorbikes, and really. And then we used to make Austin 7 specials out of old chummies and things like that. And I got to know Colin Chapman, and we used to go to the 750 Motor Club meetings in the evenings. And because I used to go to Hatfield Tech in the evenings to learn to weld and use a lathe. And DH's was there, and you know, Colin was selling aluminium for British Aluminium in those days. And Danny Margulies, who was after the war, was a bit of a forerunner, actually, going abroad racing with his cars. He had some of the early Lotuses, and he bought a C-type Jaguar from Duncan Hamilton in 1954, and Graham Hill used to be his mechanic and used to look after the cars, and they went racing together. And then Graham went to work for Lotus in the gearbox shop, and Danny said, would I like to look after his C-type, which I did in the evenings. And he said, would I like to come and do the Targa Florio with him, because I'd done quite a few races in England at Snetterton, because there were about four or five C-types kicking around in those days. Archie Scott Brown used to drive one, and there were some very promising young drivers, Max Trimble and Bill Smith. He was killed in the TT, actually, in Ireland, but I used to drive Danny's car. Danny said, would I like to come down to the Targa Florio with him? Well, I said, yes, I'd love to, and I mentioned it to my parents, and they said, well, if you go down there, don't bother come home again, you know. So I went down there. I spent months, I was bagging off corn in the grain dryer, and I had to make up my mind, and I made the decision to leave, and I never went home again. So, but I enjoyed going down to the Targa Florio. We drove the car down to Civitavecchia, caught the cattle boat down to Palermo, and I was practicing, I saw some lights flashing behind me, and suddenly this red Testarossa came by me, and it was being driven by Peter Collins with Louis Clementaski in the car as a passenger, and he gave me a cheery wave and a blast on his Fiam horns and went blasting off. Well, the C-type was no slouch. I could keep up with him on the straights, but you know, he was a far more experienced driver than I was. But to hear those four megaphones blaring at me, you know, it sort of, I thought, my God, I must get one of these one day, you know. But I mean, we were running Lotuses and things like that, and it was the only way to get into motor racing. I mean, you know, I had a Mark 6 Lotus to start with, and then we used to buy the Lotus 11s for £1,250 and put them together ourselves to save the purchase tax. But I don't want to go into my early racing history, but to bring the clock forward another 8 years, that was 1954, and then 1961, I actually got round to meeting Colonel Hoare of Marinello Concessionaires and asking him what the chances were as Ferrari dealer in England of sort of buying a racing Ferrari. And I was thinking in terms of a 250 short wheelbase at that time, but then when I saw the first GTO, I thought, well, that's got to be the car to have. And he was very helpful, and he helped me, he made it easier for me to buy the car. And the combined funds that I had and my retainer from BP at that time and Dunlop's and the money I'd made buying and selling Lancias and bringing them back from Italy and selling them through Danny Margulis, and, you know, so I could go back and get some more, you know. I used to go all around the Lancia dealerships. Mike Hawthorne introduced me to Franco della Lancia in Modena, and I started buying cars there, and then I went pounding the pavements in most of the main cities in northern Italy, buying Lancias. I used to go to breakers' yards. And
but when you finally got your first GTO, I mean, just tell us the run of races that you had. I think it'll amaze everyone just how many you managed to pack in. I mean, you were telling me literally 5 minutes ago that you did a stock car race with your GTO and bolted on stock car tyres. I mean, you're amazing. But the first GTO that you got, just tell us which races you went for.
Yeah, well, my cars had to work, you know. And I went down with Danny to pick up the car from the factory. I'd bought the car through Marinello Concessionaires, and we drove it back, and we realized what a wonderful car it was and what a pleasure it was to drive and how fast and reliable it was and how it behaved generally. And we stopped at one or two restaurants on the way back, and we were discussing what we should do with it. And Danny suggested that I do the Tour de France with the car, with him. And we do a recce in his Cooper Mini on the hill climbs, and we do the Tour de France. So the first race I did was Crystal Palace, and I shunted it into the railway sleepers, which wasn't a very good start, but it wasn't too bad. And I had to take the fuel tank back, which was all riveted, to Fontanese in Modena. And he built them. He had an old tree stump in the middle of his workshop, and he built all these beautiful aluminium fuel tanks and riveted them together with plastic between the joints. And he repaired the tank, put it back together. Then I had another shunt at Brands Hatch, but it wasn't too bad. And then we did start the Tour de France. I was getting used to the car by then. And
thank goodness for that.
We started from Lille that year, and Ronnie Hoare, the colonel, was stationed there during the war. So it was just a coincidence. And we did the Tour de France, and I met some wonderful drivers. I mean, Lucien Bianchi and Aurelier Schlesser, you know, all the classic, you know, rally drivers who knew what they were doing. And we learnt a lot on the Tour de France. You know, you didn't drive on the roads like you would on a racing circuit. You'd stay in the middle of the road so that you've got a little bit of space left. And they took us over some very difficult stages. There were 5,000 kilometres on the road, 7 hill climbs, some of them were 25 miles long, kilometres long, and all 5 very fast circuits, you know, Spa, Le Mans, Rouen, Po, Albi, you know, and it was great. We were real beginners at the game, and actually on one of the controls, we came into the control from the wrong direction, and everyone was laughing at us. But we finished fourth overall, which wasn't too bad, and my car was green, this colour, and so people would remember the car, and when I applied for entries in races in France, they'd know who they were getting. Well, that was the start. But the next session was, I got a telephone call from Ken Gregory, Sterling's manager, and he was running BRP at the time, and they'd bought a GTO, and it was green, but it wasn't the same colour green as mine, it was a lighter green. And they were going to South Africa to do the 9-hour race in Johannesburg at Kyalami. And Ken said, we've sold the car to an actor in Austria, quite a famous actor, and we haven't got the car anymore. Innes was going to drive it. You can have our entry for 10% of the starting money. Well, I knew the organizers in South Africa, and...
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
There wasn't any starting money, and so I thought, well, we better have a go at this. So we shipped the car out on the Union Castle boat. I went out with my mechanic, Fax, who was a great character. I'd met him because I used to keep the GTO in a Mews garage in London where Danny Margulis was working, and I had a lock up there, and it was in Shaftesbury Mews, West 8, and in those days all the Australians and New Zealanders were there, you know. And it was an interesting Mews because there was a chap called Polish George, and Fax was working for him, and they were making models of aeroplanes for the airline companies, you know, and he came over and had a look at my car, and he said, oh, you know, rather nice. And in the end, he said he'd like to come and work for me. Well, he was a very well-educated, very intelligent chap. He went to Gordonston, and he ended up being my mechanic for about 7 years. He was absolutely brilliant, but he was a wild chap and difficult to control. But we went out on the Union Castle boat, and I'll never forget coming into Cape Town in the morning at about 5 o'clock and seeing Table Mountain there, and the car was lifted up with a derrick and put down on the deck in those days, on the docks. In those days, that area was purely a working docks. There was only one little restaurant there called the Harbour Cafe, and all the seals used to come up and sun themselves. Anyway, Cyril Wilcox of BP was waiting for me, and he gave me 32 gallons of petrol, and we went out to the local cricket club and had lunch, and set off for Joburg. And we drove 1,000 miles up to Joburg. We arrived there at 7 o'clock at night, and I was driving with Bruce Johnson, who was a friend of Raymond May's, and he'd been driving occasionally for BRM, rather like Richard did, only he. And he was a good driver, and we embarked on the race. It was 9 hours, and the South Africans were very glad to see us. Tony Maggs and Bobby Altoff and all the local heroes in South Africa, John Love and Peter de Klerk, all the people that were very friendly, and it was a great time. I love sportsmen, people who played cricket, people came who played rugger, and people came motor racing, and socially it was a great place to be. And anyway, cut a long story short, we won the race, and it worked out very well. So then we toddled off down to Cape Town, another 1,000 miles down there, and we did the 3-hour race in Cape Town, and then I don't think we did very well there. I think we finished about 7th. Then I stuck the boat on the car on a boat at Cape Town Harbour round to Luanda in Angola. It was the Principe Perfetto. It was a cork boat that carried all the cork from the cork trees for making the corks for wine bottles, you know. And we arrived in Luanda in Angola, the race was round the streets. It was like Monte Carlo. And we were staying in the Continental Hotel. In fact, I've still got the key to my room. It was
souvenir.
All the people started arriving from Europe. There was the Marquis de Montaigu with Annie Swabo, who drove a GTO Ferrari. There was Jack Swatters with William Eres, Lucien Bianchi, and all those drivers. There was Herbert Muller from Switzerland. And it was a wonderful group of people. And it was a very wealthy country. All the pavements were beautiful mosaic, and there was a Club Naval out on a peninsula, and it was a nightclub in the base of the hotel, and lots of action there, you know. And the Automobile Club were very hospitable, and we had some wonderful racing there.
I mean, central to all of this was the man himself, Enzo Ferrari, and to, you know, for someone my age, he's sort of this mythical figure. I mean, Richard, you met him once, did you not?
I met him because I was driving at the time for, talking 66, 67, when I was driving for Maranello Concessionaires, the, you know, Ronnie Hall, the importers of Ferrari for the UK. And I can't remember why, but he had got a car with it was consuming a lot of oil, and for the factory wanted to have the car down there to sort it out. And I think it was just the valve seals, little O-rings on the valve seals that were not working properly. So I went down with Ronnie to deliver it down there, and then we flew back. And while we were there, yes, I did meet Enzo Ferrari, but it was in his very sort of dark and dingy office. You could hardly really see across the table at him, but I think he was always interested in any drivers who he might happen to see or meet, because he was always looking for the next sort of really, you know, strong driver who would actually take Ferrari beyond he was looking for the best driver, the fastest driver, I suppose. Whether they survived or not, he wasn't probably too that interested. he was on the lookout, so that's probably why I met him.
Even then, was he as revered as, you know, as the man he became to all of us?
Well, I think he was really just a very secreted away sort of man, wasn't he, really? And it was a bit of a mystery. And there were probably many people who probably wondered if he actually ever existed, you know. he spoke very little English as far as I know. So really, I think Ronnie was making the conversation. And I just happened to be there. So it wasn't, I didn't feel, you know, a great aura of feeling having met him or anything like that. But then maybe I was in my mid-20s, so I probably was a little bit underwhelmed by the aura.
And David, you got to know him quite well, to the extent that he was always giving your lovely wife scarves and chatting her up.
Oh.
Yeah, well, you're jumping a gun, you've gone miles ahead. We're back in 61 still. I hadn't arrived back in England from South Africa yet, and just to get it out of the way quickly, I'll just bore you all to death. Yeah. I got back to England, shipped the car on the QE2 to New York, drove it down through the Carolinas, did Daytona and Sebring, sold the car to Ed Cantrell, and he decided that he wanted to do some races in England, so I'll go into that later. But anyway, that was that. So as far as Ferrari's concerned, I did meet him, a friend of mine, Alan Phillips, and Daphne Barron, who was a friend of mine, was a journalist for Autosport, and he used to do the Autosport lap charts for Formula One, and we went and interviewed Enzo Ferrari in 1956, and that's the first time I met him. But I got the usual runaround, you know, but I did send my mechanic down to work at the factory in Modena in Via Veneto Trieste, number 20, Via Veneto Trieste, and that's where the Assistenza was, where all the wrecked cars were taken when they were damaged in the road and blown up in circuits and things like that, and where the customers took their cars to be maintained. And I went in there, and one day there was a lady on her hands and knees scrubbing the floors, the marble floors, and it was Mrs. Ferrari. And Enzo Ferrari, every morning, he had a routine. He used to go to Dino's grave in the northern part of Modena, then he'd come back to the hairdresser and have a shave with a cutthroat razor, you know, and then he'd go to the factory. And Peppino, his driver, and who used to be his racing mechanic, used to hang around at the Assistenza with the old man's car. At that stage, I think in 62, he had a 250 GTE with a 4-litre engine. And he did invite me up to the Gatto Verde one day and took me for a ride. It was a bit scary, up the hill, and we had a meal in the Gatto Verde. It was north of Maranello, and you could go skiing there in the winter. I used to stay there in Modena because I had a workshop there, and we used to go up there in the winter. And my workshop was about 100 yards from the test track in Modena, and I used to just wheel my car across the road and test any time I liked. But there were no marshals or anything there, but you could just use it. It was a public facility, which is quite good. Apart from that, Ed Cantrell, who bought my GTO, said he'd love to do the Nürburgring 1,000 kilometres, so we came back and did that with him. Then he said he'd like to do Monza, the 1,000K, so we did that, by which time I'd ordered another new GTO. And then when he was in Monza, we did quite well in those races. We finished quite well up, the Coppa into Europa, those races. He said, do you know a company called Agip? I said, yes. He said, would you take me to them? So I took him into Milan to Agip, and he bought one of their Learjets to take back to America. He was an incredible character. He was about 6'6" and very broad. He used to wear crocodile shoes, and he had this airfield at Zephyr Hills. And after the race at Daytona, he said, you know, I'd like to buy your car. I'd like to do Sebring with you. It was a month later. Daytona was in February, Sebring was in March. He said, come and stay with me at my house. I'll teach you to fly. You can prepare the car, and we'll do Sebring. And that's how it all happened. And so that was that. I mean, that's a short series on the first GTO. But that's enough for me.
Yeah, well...
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.